Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and today I'm very happy to be speaking to Christy Thornton. Christy is assistant professor in the sociology department at Johns Hopkins University. And we're here today to discuss her brand new 2021 book, Revolution in Development, Mexico, and the Governance of the Global Economy. It's published by the University of California Press. And Christy was also for 5 years the executive director of the North American Congress on Latin America, better known as NACLA, which for those of you who want key day-to-day information about what's going on in Latin America, really is the best, probably the best organization in the country for that. And I highly recommend you checking out the NACLA website. Christy, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Yeah, would you start by talking about your book a little bit?
Yeah, so the book is a historical study of the role of Mexico in the kind of creation and reform of various institutions and agreements that together make up what I call the governance of the global economy. Obviously, there's a sense in which the kind of global capitalist economy is not at all centrally governed, right? But we have these various kinds of institutions, trade agreements, bilateral arrangements that sort of set the rules for what happens within the global economy. And so the book really goes back and looks at Mexico from really the end of the Mexican Revolution, beginning around the 1920s, up to the transition to neoliberalism in the 1980s, to ask how this set of Mexican state representatives tried to create new rules and institutions for the global economy into which their national economy would be situated, right? So it really looks at the way that Mexican economists and diplomats and political figures tried to negotiate a kind of fairer global order through agreements about trade and investment and capital flows in that whole middle part of the 20th century.
Yeah. And so, you know, what are some of these key, you know, for I guess for our listeners who maybe have more or less fluency on both Mexico and the, and these big global financial institutions. Let's talk a little bit about some of these things in a bit of generalities first. So what are some of these core financial institutions that, you know, govern the global economy more or less during this period from the 20s to the 80s?
Yeah, so the book really started with my interest in the role of Mexico at the Bretton Woods Conference, which your listeners will know Bretton Woods is the place where the World Bank and the IMF were created. And so I had seen some mention in kind of secondary literature that Mexico was kind of given a ceremonially important role at that conference. And I wanted to figure out what that was about. And as I began to do research into the role that Mexico takes at Bretton Woods, which is that, you know, the conference is kind of divided into these three sections, one of which is to, you know, set up the International Monetary Fund, one of which is intended to negotiate the International Bank of Reconstruction and Development. And then there's a third commission that is on other means of economic and financial cooperation. And that third commission is headed by the Mexican finance minister, Eduardo Suarez. So you have Harry Dexter White from the United States, John Maynard Keynes from Great Britain, and then Eduardo Suarez from Mexico. And that seemed pretty strange to me that, you know, in 1944, they would invite this kind of Mexican finance minister to be sitting at the head of the table on which these global financial institutions were being drawn up. So I really started from there. And as I worked backwards in time and forwards in time, what I did was begin to try and understand the role that Mexico played, not only there, but in the other kinds of international financial negotiations. So the book also spends a lot of time thinking about the kind of predecessor institution to the World Bank and the IMF, which is this thing called the Inter-American Bank, which the Americans took up in 1939, 1940, which was chartered and given bylaws, but never came into being. And then I look at, for instance, the role of Mexico in the creation of the failed creation of the International Trade Organization, which follows Bretton Woods, and which also gets blocked and results in just the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT. And then I go forward in time, actually, all the way to the 1970s to try and understand the role that a country like Mexico played in that moment that was the new international economic order. And I trace how Mexican advocacy for this international charter called the Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States really shaped in important ways that whole moment of kind of third worldist economic internationalism that the NEIO represented. So, it's really all these this broad spectrum of international agreements, institutions, various sorts of arrangements about how international trade and investment especially would be kind of managed. And those are the moments at which Mexico intervenes, and I try to trace that over time.
And thinking about Mexico, I mean, you know, you're starting at a moment here, you know, shortly after the completion of the Mexican Revolution, or at least after the 1917 Constitution, and taking a nation, you know, that is, you know, has a very sort of self-identified, I think, nationalistic sense of itself after the revolution is settled, and taking it through time. And so, you know, could you talk a little bit more about the ways in which Mexico sees itself as, you know, vis-a-vis the U.S., vis-a-vis the world, as it's entering into these financial arrangements?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And I think you've hit the nail right on the head there by talking about Mexican nationalism. And that's kind of the way that we've always understood what the Mexican post-revolutionary state really pursues in terms of economic policy, kind of abiding economic nationalism. Of course, Mexico will be one of the first countries to really enter into a kind of import substitution industrialization, really kind of inward-facing model in some way. And so that, combined with the idea of the kind of nationalism of the Mexican Revolution, has allowed us to completely overlook the ways in which Mexico was actually deeply internationalist throughout this whole moment, in which they were trying to not only kind of shape their own national development strategy and think about, you know, sort of how their domestic economy should be structured, right? And of course, Mexican economists are thinking about these things. There's tussles with the industrialists and the workers, you know, the kind of typical national developmental story that we might tell. But in fact, these people were thinking about the way that the Mexican economy was deeply dependent on the broader global economy, and that the possibilities for development within Mexico were deeply shaped by how Mexico sat within that global economy. And so that has to do, obviously, a great deal with the United States. The relationship with the United States is important from the get-go. And one of the really important things that I trace in the book that, you know, helps me figure out why things change over time in the way that they do is that, you know, one of the key aspects of Mexico's relations with the rest of the world in economic terms after the revolution have to do with Mexican access to credit, to international finance. And so in the course of the Mexican Revolution, right, there are debts that are repudiated, there are investments that are destroyed. And so in the aftermath of the revolution, there are all of these international creditors really coming after the Mexican state. This begins almost immediately after the 1917 Constitution. I trace in the beginning of the book the way at the Paris Peace Conference that ended World War I, you have a bunch of creditors and other interests kind of coming to try to say the international system needs to do something about the way Mexico has repudiated these debts. So Mexico remains kind of outside of the system of international finance and credit from the revolution, really in the 1910s, all the way up into the mid-1940s. And so being kept out of that system of international debt and credit really spurred a lot of very strong activism on the part of the Mexican state to try to reform that international credit system. And in some ways, it's successful. That's one of the kind of most remarkable things about this story, is that Mexico kind of, even as some of its more kind of thoroughgoing and radical ideas about how the system could be restructured are dismissed, some of the kernel of those ideas is very much taken up, for instance, in what becomes the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the World Bank. So one of the arguments is really that the entire international system of development really comes from, in important ways, these demands from Mexico and its allies in Latin America in the pre-war period. So Mexico's kind of exclusion from that international financial system very much structures what it does. And then once that exclusion is reversed, once Mexico renegotiates the debts, these new institutions are put in place, and the capital starts flowing, and especially in the 1950s and 1960s, Mexico really backs off of this kind of strident advocacy for reform in the international system. And they begin saying, like, oh, no, actually, this is working pretty well for us. And the famous economist, Mexican economist Victor Urquidy, says this very revealing thing where he says, Bretton Woods fitted very well into Mexico's post-war needs, right? So there's very much a sense that once that capital starts flowing, Mexico no longer has to kind of champion the kind of international reform, and they actually become kind of backers of the U.S.-led system that will emerge in the post-war period. So that question of access to finance is really key to the story that I'm telling here.
And so, you know, you brought up Bretton Woods a couple of times, and I think, you know, at least my reading of your book is that it's kind of the critical moment. And you know, as you talk about in your intro, right, you have this Mexican economist or Mexican finance minister who's at the head of the table at Bretton Woods. So could you talk a little bit more about, I think that when we, I guess I'll preface this with, I feel like when we usually read and think about these big post-war financial institutions, it's very US-based or British-based. And you just, you're sort of aware that, that the global South is around, but they're not, it's not very central to the story. And here you're telling a different kind of a story about these institutions and their creations. So could you talk a little bit more about why Mexico is at the head of the table at Bretton Woods? And I guess more broadly, how this should make us rethink the history of these big post-war international financial institutions?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And my work is not alone in kind of trying to make this revision. I've worked very closely over the years with somebody like Eric Heliner, who has also written about these issues and the role of the Global South within the field of kind of international political economy. So, the way that Mexico kind of ends up sitting at the head of that table is because there is basically a decade of advocacy before that for this institution called the Inter-American Bank. And in that, the kind of reciprocal exchanges that go between the United States and the Latin American advocates of the Inter-American Bank really inform what the U.S. planners who are involved in Bretton Woods think about, and Harry Dexter White especially. So Harry Dexter White has this close personal relationship with a couple of the Mexican economists who are at Bretton Woods. And he really, you can see in reading White's papers, how much he understands that the role of U.S. leadership in Latin America and the kind of legitimacy of sort of U.S. hegemony really depends on bringing the Latin Americans along with them, right? So he is a kind of real believer, even as he is the person who kind of builds in dollar supremacy and gets what the United States wants out of the Bretton Woods moment. He also really believes that the kind of multilateral legitimacy by bringing along these Latin American countries will be super important to the kind of longevity of these institutions. And so the Mexicans and their allies, frankly, in other parts of Latin America, make a bunch of really important demands. And at Bretton Woods in particular, probably the most important one is the demand for that development be part of the purview of these institutions, right? There's very much a sense at that moment that what they are talking about is the reconstruction of Europe, and that that's the US's priority, that that's what, the IMF will eventually work on, that that's what the loans the World Bank will make will do. And the Mexicans show up and they say, we need you to talk about development. Like, reconstruction is going to happen. It's going to be this kind of particular period. And after that, you're going to have to deal with the industrialization of the non-industrialized or less industrialized countries. And so they really show up, and, the way that I characterize it in the book throughout this whole period is what Mexican representatives are looking for is representation in these institutions. That is a kind of vote, a seat at the table, and redistribution. They want kind of new mechanisms for making sure that northern capital, sort of surplus capital from the north, can be distributed in equitable and productive ways to the global south. And so that fight for representation and redistribution really defines what Mexico does at the Inter-American Bank, in Bretton Woods, and then going forward, all the way up into the Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States. So I really think that that demand, we need to recognize the extent to which the institutions as they are created is in response to these patently obvious ways in which this is an asymmetrical structure of power and the United States kind of has the preponderant power in this moment. But understanding that U.S. hegemony in the post-war period was not sort of sheer domination or kind of some structural force of capitalism, but actually involved these kind of close negotiations with the demands from below in order to maintain the legitimacy of that new hegemonic system. So that's something that is really important to the story that I'm telling. And I think that there are a number of places where there are kind of inflection points. Bretton Woods is one. The Inter-American Bank was one. Frankly, the 1948 International Trade Organization agreement was another important one where the actors from the Global South and Mexico in particular really come to the table and force U.S. government officials to take on board some of their criticisms, to take up some of their demands. And in some cases, they are then subsequently blocked by especially representatives of the U.S. business class, but in organizations like the National Association of Manufacturers and the National Foreign Trade Council, who lobby their congressional representatives and things like the Senate Banking Committee. But it's remarkable the extent to which these Mexican representatives over and over are actually able to convince their counterparts within the US government to kind of take some of their criticisms on board and to assimilate some of the logics about the kind of reciprocal nature of the global economy that Mexico is putting on the table.
I want to talk in a second a little bit more about the kind of the relationship between Mexico and the US on this and the ways in which Americans respond. But, you know, a couple of times you brought up, you know, Mexico's allies in Latin America. And I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about the overall, the Latin American scene, I guess, for lack of a better term at this time, and the way in which Mexico maybe takes the lead, and why is Mexico, if that's the case, why is Mexico the lead nation in representing these ideas as opposed to perhaps a Brazil or an Argentina or others of the larger South American nations?
Yeah, that's a good point. And so I should say that in many cases, Mexico sort of self-appoints in this leadership role to the chagrin of these other nations, right? So an important aspect of that is in the early 1930s, when these ideas about the Inter-American Bank first start circulating, the Mexican foreign minister at the time, whose name is José Manuel Puy Casarranc, he goes to this important meeting in Montevideo in 1933 to argue for a kind of continental debt jubilee. He wants there to be a moratorium on debt payments for a decade because the Great Depression has created such, you know, massive defaults all over the region. And in that moment, you can see this really tense fight between Mexico and Argentina, because Argentina is the one country in the region that actually hasn't defaulted on its federal level debts. There are defaults at the lower levels in the Argentine government. But the Argentines are like, you know, what the hell are you doing? You're trying to create, you know, you're trying to make us all into kind of paupers here. And we're completely unwilling to go along with Mexico's leadership here. So there are important moments when, in fact, Mexico kind of self-appoints as a leader, and there is great pushback from other Latin American countries. So it is a story of cooperation in many cases, but it's also a story of contest. And the contest is over kind of questions about leadership. It's about questions of vision. And I think it comes out most clearly, actually, once we move into the post-war period and we're in the 1960s, and then especially in the 1970s, Mexico takes this kind of very difficult role as a kind of mediator between United States, particularly in the Nixon administration, and once, you know, the gold window gets closed after August of 1971, the kind of unilateral economic actions that the United States is taking, and the much more radical demands that are then coming from third world actors, especially in things like the non-aligned movement. You have, you know, Algeria and obviously the Cubans and the Chileans kind of arguing for that the current system needs to be overthrown, that it needs to be done away with and kind of something new created. And Mexico, actually, because of this history of the conservatism that emerges in the 50s and 60s, emerges as this kind of hinge point between the, you know, the North and the US especially, and these more radical countries in the global South, in Latin America and beyond. Algeria is especially important. And so Mexico kind of, in that moment, self-appoints this role as this mediator between these two poles, the kind of intransigent United States and a really radical, especially non-aligned movement. And so Mexico is able to do this because, not only because of the long history of cooperation between the United States and Mexico, but because of the logic of the Cold War in that moment, Mexico's sort of positioning itself as, you know, anti-communist, as you know, progressive on economic issues, but deeply anti-communist, allows people like Kissinger and Nixon to see Mexico as kind of key to a geostrategic project that is involved in keeping Latin America in the US camp in the Cold War. So Mexico takes advantage of those kinds of geopolitical questions to really push its economic interests at various points over the book. And so, yeah, I would just emphasize that there are many points at which Mexico absolutely sort of pushes collaboration and cooperation with other global South, third world, Latin American countries. But there are also these really important moments of contest that structure this as well. So it's not a simple kind of North-South story in that way.
You know, to kind of go back to what, it was kind of prefacing earlier, you know, when I'm reading your book, I mean, one of the things that comes to light is a sort of amusement, I guess, in a sense that the sort of varied American responses between, you know, happy to have this partner, but also like incredible irritation that Mexico is not just doing whatever it is the U.S. says, right?
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, Kissinger certainly expressed this, but also before. So, you know, what could you talk a little bit more about that relationship between Mexico and the U.S. and the ways in which U.S. policymakers are sort of having to, you know, begrudgingly take Mexico seriously as an international power in the way that maybe they didn't really want to?
Yeah, I think just as, you know, it's not a simple story of kind of one side versus the other when it comes to North and South, it's also not a simple story kind of within the U.S. state that like various U.S. state agencies are like, yes, we want to do this, or no, we don't want to do this. Of course, those who are familiar with kind of U.S. International financial history will know the kind of deep contention in, for instance, the Bretton Woods moment between the vision that the State Department has and the vision that the Treasury Department has. And in many ways, some of those fights kind of play out over the involvement of countries like Mexico in these things. So it probably comes out most clearly in the book in the discussion of the 1970s. And it's because we have these Nixon tapes, right? We have these recordings of everything that he says. And so we can really see what he thinks about this. And so he does this incredible thing when the Mexican president in the early 1970s, Luis Echeverria, comes to the White House to meet with Nixon and Kissinger. Nixon says this thing where he says, I want the voice of Latin America to be the Echeverria doctrine, right? That Echeverria and Mexico will be a kind of bulwark against Salvador Allende in Chile and Fidel Castro in Cuba. And that, you know, the kind of Mexican model in that sense is how he wants Latin America to kind of stay in the U.S. camp. And so he kind of convinces Echeverria of this, and Echeverria goes and he meets with a bunch of business leaders, et cetera. When Echeverria kind of leaves and the door closes, Nixon turns to H.R. Haldeman and he says something like, you know, the Mexicans are liberal as hell, meaning left-leaning economically. They're liberal as hell, but they're anti-communist, right? So we can work with them. And that is the logic that is working there, because it's very much the idea that, and this is part of, Kissinger is very concerned with the role of Latin America as the non-aligned movement really is kicking off. And he tries to make sure that Latin America is going to stay in the U.S.'s camp by calling these inter-American conferences. And so he's very concerned with keeping Mexico friendly to the United States and not allowing them to kind of tip over too far toward Allende, toward Castro, and kind of, you know, lose the influence that the United States has after the U.S. votes against the Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States at the U.N. General Assembly in late 1974. Kissinger says this thing where he says, Echeverria was always a third worlder, and now he's going to be unloosed, right? And that is what happens. In fact, the Mexico votes against U.S. interests in a number of really crucial U.N. votes, especially the one that condemns Zionism as racism immediately after that. And so the idea of kind of keeping Mexico in the U.S. camp is something that, you know, within the U.S. state, people are fighting over constantly. And that's really detailed in the book.
Yeah, and you know, I guess to... So we have about 10 minutes left to think about sort of the closer to the end of the book. And the 70s is this kind of sort of last moment of Mexican leadership, perhaps, on these issues before the debt crisis in 82. And I guess what happens in the 70s to kind of bring this this history to a close, or at least a turning point?
Yeah, there's a number of important things that happen. And it really is the kind of, you know, I say in some ways that what happens in the 70s is really the culmination of the vision that the Mexicans have put forward in the earlier periods, but it's also kind of its last gasp, right? So the developmental model that Mexico is pushing from the 20s forward, right, is about industrialization, especially import substitution industrialization where necessary, but also deeply reliant on foreign investment. So despite the fact that the, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, overall foreign investment was relatively low. This is the kind of high period of the Mexican miracle and import substitution industrialization. Those sectors that have that foreign investment are the most dynamic ones in the Mexican economy, right? So particularly after 65, when you have the border industrialization program, which we know now as the kind of maquiladora program, as that industrialization really takes off and foreign investment, and particularly U.S. investment, is so important to it, that really ties Mexico's hands with regard to their kind of ability to be autonomous from either the U.S. state or the U.S. capital. And so the increasing reliance on that foreign investment is super important. But in the 1970s, you know, there are kind of two things that happen at once that really define how Mexico pursues this idea of the Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States. So the first is obviously the end of the Bretton Woods system when Nixon sort of takes the dollar off of gold. He also does this important thing that we tend not to remember, which is that he puts a 10% import tax on, you know, all imports coming into the United States. And Mexico, whose export economy is deeply linked to the U.S., sees this as a real kind of unilateral affront, that there's just suddenly a new 10% tariff on all imports from Mexico. And so that really pushes Mexico back into a position of leadership for reform, even as they're still very much constrained by their kind of tied into that economy, right? So I think that moment of the 1970s is about Echeverria and his team trying to negotiate that tension between seeing that the existing system has these really intense flaws and is not working, and the kind of more radical countries are saying, we've been completely excluded from this, right? But also needing to maintain its kind of standing as a good debtor, right? Maintain its credit rating, especially. And it does so. And the other thing that's happening in the world economy that's so important at that moment, of course, is the massive increase in petrodollar lending. So over the course of the 1970s, right, as Mexico has been pushing for the previous 40, 50 years about access to international credit, right, all of a sudden the world is just awash in these petrodollars, and northern banks are looking for outlets for lending, and they see Mexico, which has managed to make itself into this good credit risk. And so there are just billions and billions and billions of dollars of loans being, you know, dumped into Mexico at the time. And Echeverria is able to use them to kind of paper over some of his internal failures. He fails to pass tax reform. The business class completely blocks it. And so he uses some of this lending to do kind of social spending and populist programs. And that continues under his successor, José López Portillo. And so as they are kind of arguing that the international system does need to be reformed, they are also just taking on literally tens of billions of dollars of debt at the same time. And that is what is going to lead into the 1982 debt crisis, which will then kind of undo the entire project that they've been working on. And that's kind of, I end the book by talking about the sort of irony of Mexico having pushed so hard for these institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, and those institutions then being the ones that are used